So the floor now to Karen, with some particular issue related to a very big problem, which is a translational discovery.
Well, I should probably start by saying that discovery is definitely not a paper tiger. It is certainly a tiger, not only with flesh and blood, with very big teeth. And although this seems fairly innocuous, this is just one example of U.S. law concerning discovery. This is what the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure say. But the importance is how it's applied. Note that anything that can be defended as being relevant to a party's claim, whether or not it's eventually admissible, is pretty much fair game. And those of you who have never had anything to do with American litigation, just to give you an example, when I was a young lawyer, my firm worked on the IBM antitrust case. Not only did IBM rent a building with 5 floors just for discovery documents, there were many attorneys at the firm who spent at least 5 years doing nothing but document production. So discovery is a very real tiger. What can we do against it? Well, in the United States, there are at least some ways of resisting some kinds of discovery. The most, well, for those of us in the room who are practicing attorneys, probably the most important one is the attorney-client privilege. This is something that exists in American law and arguably does not exist outside of common law countries. It certainly does exist in the UK and in a number of other countries. There are some countries that have something similar to the attorney-client privilege. Switzerland is not one of them, and as I'm sure you all know, the European Union is also not one of those areas, at least with respect to competition law. But let me specify that what I'm talking about is a real privilege. What's the difference between a privilege and what you find in many civil law jurisdictions? Many civil law jurisdictions allow or have some obligation of confidentiality for an attorney with respect to communications with clients. But often that is something that may be outweighed by some greater importance. Privilege under U.S. attorney-client privilege law is absolute and inviolable. This is something you can't touch. And the other aspect of privilege that's perhaps important to note it is that this is something that belongs to clients, not to attorneys. Only a client can waive a privilege. This is not necessarily the way duties of confidentiality are handled in civil law countries. Since we've had a wonderful demonstration of American conflicts of law, I will try and restrict myself to the only aspects that have to do specifically with the subject at hand. But perhaps I should just start with why am I talking to you about this subject? From a Swiss political point of view, the reason that I'm talking about this subject is that there have been a number of cases litigated in the U.S. courts in which Swiss companies have been involved. I'm sure if Mr. Vengen were here, he would be happy to talk to you about that. And there have been situations in which U.S. courts have held that U.S. law applies to the question of whether attorney-client privilege is available to U.S. clients, but that Swiss law applies to attorney-client privilege with respect to Swiss litigants, meaning that the American companies can shield themselves from extensive discovery, whereas the Swiss companies have to produce all of the documents requested. As you can imagine, that gives unhappy results for the Swiss companies. So there is a parliamentary initiative, a copy of which is out on the table, though for those of you who haven't picked it up, with a translation for Americans, that attempts to at least level the playing field. And I'm here to talk to you about whether or not if that parliamentary initiative is adopted and becomes law, whether that will actually solve the problem. The answer to that question is to some extent, but not completely. So let me explain why that's true. Well, first of all, for a U.S. court faced with these issues, the first step that a U.S. court will take is to determine which law applies to the determination of whether attorney-client privilege applies to a specific communication. Communication can be testimony, it can be documents, it can be any number of things. I'll just refer to them as communications to simplify things. Unfortunately, under American conflicts law, there is relatively little uniformity. I think that Professor Mignonis had made that very clear, but just to hammer the point home, these five issues are some of the examples of the type of approaches that are used by American courts to determine choice of law. There's the obvious choice of the forum law, which, as we've explained, this will depend on whether the issue of attorney-client privilege is considered to be a substantive issue or a procedural issue. There's relatively little uniformity on that question. It's been argued that restatement first of conflicts follows one area. In federal court, there are the federal rules of evidence, which specify that in diversity cases, one should apply the law of the decision. There are issues of comity. Well, I'll give you a couple of examples of how some of these tests are used. And in particular, we'll talk about the last one. Unfortunately, most of, how can I say this properly? Most of the answers to these questions are questions that will be determined by a court. There's very little statutory resolution or even the possibility of statutory resolution of these issues. And therefore, we're very dependent on the case law. In this particular area, unfortunately, most of the case law that exists is in a single circuit, in the Second Circuit, and in particular in the Southern District of New York. So I'm afraid this presentation will be a little weighted towards the Southern District of New York's approach to these issues. Just bear in mind that that's not necessarily going to be the law that would apply to any U.S. litigation concerning a Swiss company. So, if we walk through the choice of law analysis, I will not spend any time on this. Well, perhaps I should spend 2 seconds on the issue of whether this is a question of law or a question of fact. Obviously, the legal aspect of what attorney-client privilege is and what rules apply to attorney-client privilege is a question of law. But of course, what interests litigants is whether a specific communication is protected by the privilege, and that's a question of fact. And since in the U.S. system, questions of fact belong only to the court of first instance, and in many cases, simply to motion practice, which means it's before you even get to the first trial, most of the decisions that we have are on very lower court levels. So we can't have a wonderful discussion about what the various members of the Supreme Court think about this because these issues will never get up there. And because the determination has to be made on a communication-by-communication basis, imagine the amount of time and energy that goes into litigating this issue for a five-story building full of documents if the question is raised for each document. These are, unfortunately, situations where the tail wags the dog. So let's just look at a couple of the more common tests. One is the most significant relation test. This is where the court is faced with the possibility of deciding between, well, in our example, between American law applying to the attorney-client privilege or Swiss law. The most significant relationship test requires that the court look at each venue's policies concerning attorney-client privilege. So what do American courts think about attorney-client privilege as opposed to what do Swiss courts think about attorney-client privilege? Which of these issues are more compelling? And depending on which one we decide is more compelling, that's the law we should apply. And cases have told us that in making that decision, these are some of the elements: the number and nature of contacts, the materiality of the evidence in question, that is the specific document we're talking about, what type of privilege involved, well, in our case, we're only talking about attorney-client privilege, but that can vary. And you note that there's this lovely little fairness to the parties, something which obviously how this is interpreted will vary enormously from one court to another. And when we're looking at motion practice, it's very hard to know in advance what that might be. This is what the restatement second of conflicts, or one arm of it, has to say about this instance, about this question, which is the most significant relationship. And the law of the state that has the most significant relationship with this question, with respect to this specific communication, is the law that will be applied. But note the caveat. The unless the admission of such evidence would be contrary to the strong public policy of the forum, this is something that raises issues. And in some cases, these issues have been dispositive. Theoretically, these cases fall under the comedy approach, but they're similar issues. In the Astra case, the courts were faced with a choice between applying American attorney-client privilege or Korean attorney-client privilege. And the argument was made that even though Korean law, which probably was the law that should apply, Korean law does not provide for an attorney-client privilege. If one stopped the analysis there, the American courts would simply have said, well, let's apply Korean law, no attorney-client privilege, all the documents come in. But the argument was made that under Korean law, there's virtually no discovery. So they don't need attorney-client privilege because there is no discovery. And applying Korean law specifically to that issue without looking at the entire context would have meant that affording comedy to Korean law would give a result which is exactly the opposite of what you would find if you actually applied Korean law. So in that case, the court just decided that it would be easier to apply American law. They applied American law, found that a privilege exists, and disallowed some of the documents. Well, in a subsequent case in which the court was faced with choosing between American law and Chinese law, they tried to make the same argument. But this time, the court said, well, no, there is discovery in China, so we'll apply Chinese law. These are both Southern District of New York cases. So even within the very small jurisdiction of the Southern District of New York, for those of you who are not Americans, that means New York City, essentially, very difficult to know what the outcome is going to be. And then the test that's used in the most recent cases in the Southern District of New York is what's been referred to as the touch-base test. So one looks at the communication and decides whether the communication touches base with the United States, and if that's the case, then we apply U.S. law, and if not, we apply the law of the foreign country. Well, here, even within the Southern District of New York, not to mention outside of the Southern District of New York, there's a fair amount of variation as to what that means. There are cases that have held that what we're looking for is the place that has the most predominant or the most compelling interest in whether the privilege is granted with respect to a specific document. There are cases which have held that the place where the relationship was entered into is that place. There have been attempts to sort of make rules so that there's at least some guidance here. There are cases that have held that the place where the privilege relationship was centered at the time the communication was made is the place. And in each case, there's always this exception of whether or not this will violate foreign public policy. That is, if the U.S. court has a sufficiently strong policy, and that policy usually is full discovery, which, as we've already seen, is the American way, that is can be sufficient, at least, to outweigh any public policy of another country. And then there's at least one case in California that applied the same test, but said that what that test meant was that as long as there was a connection that was more than nearly incidental, that was enough. So, yes, this is an issue. There is very little guidance. How can Swiss companies protect themselves against or know in advance what's going to happen? Very difficult. To that extent, this initiative, which essentially offers something similar to attorney-client privilege or allows someone who works within a corporate legal department, if that corporate legal department is directed by someone who has a brevet d'avocat, that those people working in that legal department will be entitled to refuse to collaborate with a request for production of documents or request for evidence, in the hopes that if American courts choose to apply Swiss law to that issue, that the answer will no longer be Swiss law has no attorney-client privilege, and therefore those documents come in. To that extent, this could be very useful. But we can't stop there, because even in the cases where American law might apply, one might think, okay, if American law applies, we're safe, U.S. law provides for the attorney-client privilege, we're okay. Well, that's not necessarily going to be the way the court approaches this issue. A privilege in the United States and how that privilege is applied, again, varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. I've given you four examples of what some courts have said is the definition of someone, of an attorney who's entitled to the privilege, that is someone who's licensed to practice law or someone who's authorized to practice law in any state or nation. Some states it's authorized to practice law in that specific state. Some cases refer to whether or not the person is admitted to practice, and some refer to member of the bar of the court. Well, how does that play when you're looking at a Swiss juris d'entreprise? Assuming in Switzerland, perhaps I should explain for the Americans why this is an issue. In Switzerland, in order to become an attorney, not only do you need your legal studies, you need a clerkship, then you need to pass a bar exam, and then generally you're registered with the bar. But you can only be registered with the bar if you are independent. And anyone who works in-house, because their client is their employer, is by definition not independent and therefore cannot be a member of the bar. This is why the attorney-client, well, the secret professionnel does not apply to in-house counsel. So, question, would the adoption of this initiative solve the problem? Maybe yes and maybe no. Because depending on which of these criteria you look at, well, if it's member of the bar, clearly the answer is no. If you're working in-house, you are not a member of the bar. Are you admitted to practice? Well, that depends on how you define whether or not you're admitted to practice. If you have to be admitted to practice in the state, that's yet another issue. All is not lost, however, because there is one aspect of American law that may be helpful for Swiss in-house counsel, and that is that many courts in the United States have held that the attorney-client privilege extends not just to lawyers admitted to the bar, but also to those people who are subordinates of the attorney, agents of the attorney, or who are directly supervised by an attorney. So to the extent that the brevet is deemed equivalent to bar admission, this will solve the problem. But there's no guarantee that that will be the case. So solution to the problem, partial, perhaps. We'll all just have to wait and see what the Southern District of New York has to say about it if the Swiss adopt it. And anyone who has questions should feel free to contact me.
Thank you very much for this insight of this other very menacing animal, which is US discovery.